in growing numbers of patients to realize this glaring error, an error fueled by the dogma taught in medical schools. Martin identified four distinct groups of people involved in making up the medical establishment. 1. Sincere, honest, able investigators who can and have followed revolutionary lines of thought to the everlasting benefit of mankind. 2. Men just as honest and sincere, but who are or have been enchanted with false concepts, and who, in a misguided manner, would sponsor either worthless or harmful modalities. 3. Dishonest, incompetent, or deceitful individuals who, in seeking self-advantage, would risk or actually cause harm to humanity. 4. Investigators who work for large profit-making corporations who often do not have the wherewithal to object to their work being distorted or shelved for reasons of profit. From my own experience and knowledge of the workings of the pharmaceutical industry, this outlines precisely where we've gone wrong with advances in cancer treatment, where it has faltered and failed. Ultimately, it was all about profit over health. A healthy patient earns nothing for the pharmaceutical companies, whereas unhealthy individuals provide all sorts of lucrative possibilities. Further research revealed dipridamole, DPM, had been used alongside AZT for patients with AIDS in the 1980s because of its antiviral properties. So perhaps it would help against HPV, Epstein-Barr, CMV, and other viruses now proven to be linked to cancer. In 2014, the University of Pittsburgh began recruiting for a trial to include dipridamole once again for HIV immune activation in combination with the antiretroviral drugs. Dipridamole beckoned to me like a siren to a sailor, but who could I get to prescribe it? I decided to ask Dr. Calibou. Gripping my copy of the Townsend letter in my hand, I made an urgent appointment with him. Guru that he is, I felt sure he would know about it. He rubbed his beard thoughtfully.
"I read about this in the 1980s," he said. "I wondered if there would ever be further developments for its use in cancer. I thought it had gone in the dustbin of history, never to be heard of again. Dipridamole was thought of as relatively ineffectual for heart disease until it was used in conjunction with aspirin, at which point they realized it improved the effects of both significantly." It seemed as if the whole medical profession was neglecting the potential of dipridamole. Even for heart disease and strokes, it was only being used at later stages. Would it not be a good prophylactic drug used with aspirin and magnesium instead of the widespread use of statins? Or should it, in fact, be used with statins? Later studies have suggested that this would indeed be a major improvement on the current guidelines. They work in synergy, improving cerebrovascular circulation by 50% after a stroke. "Are there any side effects I should know about?" I asked.
"Well, your blood pressure may drop a bit, so we need to watch that, and you might get some headaches to begin with."
He ran some checks on my blood pressure and other standard tests, and saw no reason why he shouldn't write out a prescription straight away. I rushed, huffing and puffing, to the nearest chemist to get it. From then on, I would take both dipridamole and aspirin and magnesium. Dipridamole might buy me some time. I couldn't risk more chemotherapy. It would see me off this planet. So cautiously, I began by taking 100 mg dipridamole pill daily for a week, then increased it to twice a day, although the article had suggested 300 mg a day. I was nervous about what I was doing, but what had I got to lose?
Chapter 11. An Arsenal of Big Guns.
While my discovery of dipridamole was like finding an angel in hell, I wasn't sure it would be enough to stop the impending disaster of leukemia. I was still very uneasy about the state of my health and desperate to find more big guns. Perhaps I could add to my aspirin-dipridamole drug combination. What else might I have missed in the medical literature? Were there any other drugs that had escaped the attention of the medical profession, ignored or forgotten? I had put aside several journal reports over the years, and I went through them all again, searching for anything I might have not spotted. It was then that I came across a piece on lovastatin in the American Association of Cancer Research Journal from 2001. 5 of 20 patients at the University of Toronto, Ontario, who had either head and neck or cervical cancer, had achieved stable disease after other conventional therapies had failed by taking this simple statin drug. But would it also be useful for leukemia? I wanted to prevent any return of cervical cancer too, so naturally I investigated. For me, clinging on to life by my fingernails, anything that might offer stable disease was seriously exciting. What other cancers was lovastatin good for? And was it the best statin? I found several pieces of research by the same team in Toronto, led by Linda Z. Penn, who had been exploring lovastatin and its use for cancers that responded to retinoid treatments. Retinoids are vitamin A analogues, and Dr. Calibou had already put me on a dose of emulsified vitamin A by the name of A-mulsin-hoc-kun-zentrat. Research suggested lovastatin was more effective and less toxic. The statin had caused pronounced apoptosis in acute myeloid leukemias, hurrah, and neuroblastomas, and was also effective for various pediatric cancers, as well as head and neck and cervical cancers. Bingo! Another shiver of excitement went down my spine. But then I discovered something else. One of my regular reads was the monthly Life Extension magazine, a great journal for health hackers like myself. It was in there I read a letter, structured by the editor for patients to take to their oncologists, proposing a combination of both a statin, they suggested lovastatin, and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. This combination was shown as being more effective for causing apoptosis, cell death, than using an NSAID, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, on its own, by triggering something called a caspase cascade. It was news to me that an NSAID, such as ibuprofen, indomethacin, or celecoxib, but not aspirin, caused apoptosis at all. How had I missed that? I thought the COX-2 enzyme inhibitors I'd investigated in 1999 would merely stop it growing. Perhaps aspirin, which had been the main focus of my research, was not a strong enough COX-2 inhibitor to perform this apoptotic function, and it needed a more powerful NSAID to send it into a death spiral. Life Extension magazine suggested the combined use of lovastatin and etodolac as a safer, more gut-tolerated COX-2 inhibiting drug than many of the others. It was usually prescribed for arthritis. The journal had followed up a report in the Wall Street Journal that COX-2 inhibitors were proving to be useful for the prevention and treatment of many cancers, as COX was a fuel that drove them. But the really interesting fact they shared was taken from the journal Gastroenterology, which showed that taken together, the statin increased the cancer-killing effect of an NSAID, in this case Sulindac, by as much as 5 times. There was clearly a huge synergy between NSAIDs and statins for triggering this normal process of cell death. This statin and etodolac drug combination was beckoning to me again.
yet another elixir lost in the rabbit hole. I wondered if I could take both these drugs alongside the dipridamole. Would there be a bad interaction, or would they be synergistic, further magnifying their anti-cancer effects? Who could I get to prescribe the statin and etodolac combination? Dr. Caliboo wouldn't be happy about prescribing yet more drugs, so I decided to try my oncologist. She was forward-thinking and generally open-minded. I felt guilty that I was withholding so much from her. I didn't dare tell her about the dipridamole, which might put her off prescribing the etodolac and statin. But this was my life in the balance, my decision, my choice. And discussing myelodysplasia would add confusion and delay. I was quite clear I wanted no more chemotherapy, but if there were drugs that would help, I didn't want to have to wait until the cancer had progressed. I wanted them now. With huge trepidation, I took the articles and the letter from Life Extension to my next appointment. I had expected a bit of a battle and debate after her reaction on the phone to the P53 protein test. In fact, I expected her to refuse. But she was far more receptive to the idea than I expected. She had been investigating the use of statins herself. A stroke of luck. "You might have helped me shortcut some of my research," she said. She decided on balance that prescribing the two drugs off-label, not for their intended use, was fine, given my stage 4 cervical diagnosis. But she was clearly still worried about my P53 status, or lack thereof. She also warned me of potential gut issues with the etodolac and to look out for any muscle weakness with the lovastatin, which was a rare side effect. I promised I'd be careful. When I got out of the consultation, I gave a jubilant yelp, hugged Andrew, and told him I was going to be okay. I felt sure of it. He grinned, happy that whatever was happening was going in the right direction. He had every faith in his medical Sherlock Holmes. I would check for interactions with Dr. Caliboo once I had the drugs in my possession. The statin would starve the cancer of mevalonate and cholesterol. The etodolac would quell its inflammatory COX component that fueled its growth and tip it into a death spiral, apoptosis, in combination with the statin. The dipridamole would starve the cancer of adenosine, thymidine, and uridine, proteins for making new DNA. I would starve the cancer of glucose and other fats with my diet and supplements. Both cervical cancer and leukemia were driven by the RAS gene. I had deduced this from the research, and the RAS gene controlled the mevalonate pathway, which produced cholesterol. In other words, both cancers fueled themselves in a similar way. So perhaps there was a common cancer stem cell that had started both. But would blocking cholesterol be bad for the rest of my body? Many people were taking statins long term, and the downsides seemed to be few when you compared a statin to chemo. Besides, I was taking the statin for cancer, not heart disease. Chemo might shrink tumors, but when it came to survival, it only helped by a pathetic 2.7%. The statin on its own seemed to stabilize disease in leukemia and advanced cervical cancer. It was clearly a big gun. What would be the effect of adding all the drugs together? I would swap the aspirin for the stronger NSAID for 3 months, then go back to aspirin if my stomach was okay. I had already been on the dipridamole-aspirin combo for a couple of months. I would withhold this for a month while I tried the etodolac-statin combination. The statin and NSAID seemed to be more important drugs for the leukemia, and the dipridamole might or might not enhance the effect. I would take regular markers and find out. I had nothing to lose and everything to gain by trying. The long-held magic bullet theory was a dead duck. There was never going to be a cure-all drug. That much was obvious. I was certain that what I needed was a combination of drugs attacking